Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning the programme with that rare type of political debate. It's intensely emotional, it's complex, it deals with one of the greatest things of all, the way we die, or at least some of us. And it involves a large minority of lawmakers saying that they don't just feel torn, that they simply don't quite know how they're going to vote, and that the chances are they'll make up their minds only when they've listened in detail to the arguments. As I say, it's a rare sort of debate, and it's been going on today for the best part of 5 hours in the British Parliament. It's on what's called assisted dying, legislation to allow doctors in England and Wales to help some terminally ill people to die when they choose. The vote in the House of Commons in Westminster is due to happen while we're on air. Unusually, this is not a government bill. It's coming from a backbench Labour Member of Parliament, Kim Leadbeater. She said that the current system was failing and robbing those who are terminally ill and suffering of choice.
Any one of us or our loved ones could be unfortunate or unlucky enough to receive a terminal diagnosis. And I struggle to see how it is fair or just to deny anyone the autonomy, dignity and personal choice that we might want to take control of our final weeks. And the right to choose does not take away the right not to choose. Giving the choice of an assisted death to those who want it would, of course, not stop anyone who is terminally ill from choosing not to do so.
Mary Kelly Foy is also a Labour MP, but she said in the chamber that she will vote no. Her concerns centre on her experience with her daughter Maria, who was born with a number of health conditions.
We were told many times that she might have only 6 months to live. She lived for 27 years. Crucially, Maria was non-verbal. And I am filled with dread and fear for those other people like Maria who are non-verbal and don't have that capacity, and what might happen to others like Maria if they aren't loved and cared for and have somebody speaking out for them.
This is an issue, as you can see, which cuts across party lines. Indeed, across the chamber on the Conservative benches, the MP Andrew Mitchell explains why he had changed his mind, why he's gone from opposing assisted dying to supporting it.
And the reason for that is that I've sat in my advice surgery and I have had tears pouring down my face listening to constituents who have set out so clearly, speaking with such emotion about how their mother, brother, father or child has died in great pain and great indignity. And I strongly support this bill. I want to congratulate the Honourable Lady for the excellent way in which she has presented it.
Against that view, another Conservative MP, Danny Kruger, who insisted that the focus should be on improving rather than curtailing end-of-life care.
Mr. Speaker, if I voted for this bill, I would have on my conscience many more people whose voices we cannot hear. Yes. The people who would be vulnerable in consequence of the huge changes that this bill would induce in our society and in the NHS. And my view is that if we get our broken palliative care system right and our wonderful hospices properly funded, we can do so much more for all the people that we'll hear about today.
Well, let's explore the arguments in a bit more depth now. One of the most prominent critics of the bill is the former British Paralympian Tanny Gray-Thompson. She's a member of the upper chamber, the House of Lords, which would also consider the bill should it pass the Commons today. Why does she oppose the idea?
The bill that we have in front of us is very wide open, and there's very easy sound bites to say why the law should be changed, but the devil is always in the detail, and this bill allows doctor shopping, it allows the doctor to suggest it to the patients. And for me, every jurisdiction around the world, either through the court system or through legislation or through process, has widens the access that people have. And I think what I'm saying is we need to go into this with our eyes open. And, you know, there's also many jurisdictions where their world ranking on the palliative care register has gone down.
And some of the people who are in favour of approving this legislation are saying, you know, they absolutely hear you. And in a way, they wouldn't necessarily disagree with you, because what they're saying is that, without sort of getting too lost in the jargon for our listeners, I mean, this is the second reading. It's not the end of the process, that there would be a lot of scrutiny and debate over this. Members of Parliament would consider many of the things that you're talking about. And it's actually only when it comes back to the House of Commons right at the end of that process that there will be a a vote on exactly how this legislation would work. So some of the doubts that you have, perhaps they could be addressed. But this is the start of the process, not the end of it.
This is not a small bill. Any bit of it can be amended later. There's already MPs talking about wanting euthanasia. There's people saying the safeguards are too strict, we need to relax them. We do need to have this debate. I do not want to close down the debate, but we're not going to be looking for coercion. The numbers could be huge.
Can I just ask you on that? What makes you so certain that, I mean, given the sensitivities, completely understandably, that there are about coercion in this particular case, the idea that people could somehow be forced in some way to decide that they need to end their lives, maybe earlier than they would want to. Mm. Given the focus on that, surely doctors, the High Court judge that would be involved, would be on the lookout.
Well, I work on coercive legislation as well, and we know doctors and police are not very good at spotting it. It's very difficult to prove because a lot of it is very low level. You know, if you loved me, you wouldn't dress like that. If you loved me, you wouldn't see a family. If you loved me, you'd let me go. But I'm really worried that doctors will have any time to do this. You know, a GP's appointment in the UK is 7 minutes. Are they going to be able to set aside time to actually really look into this? And the family court division, who would have to oversee these cases, there's already a backlog of 103,000 children who are waiting to hear the cases. This could be another 400 hours a year per judge. We could dispute the numbers. I've tried to take a very conservative estimate of what that court time would look like, but how does the family division then decide which case has the priority over another? And this is not the place to do it, but, you know, what drugs will be used, what intervention, what happens if the drugs don't work? There are a number of cases around the world where it takes, you know, 100 hours for someone to die.
I guess the big ticket issue as far as proponents of this legislation are concerned is that if we do not offer people the option, then you are sentencing some people who know for certain that they are going to die within a short period of time to a level of suffering. It could be emotional, it could well be physical, it could be a combination of the two, which they do not need to go through.
When people are arguing for choice, choice is one thing, but when we legislate for choice and it is taken away from others, so, you know, there are already disabled people who experience massive discrimination through employment, through education, through healthcare, who feel they would have no choice. You know, I do not want anyone to die in pain. There is, and I don't think there's reason to do that. But we have to change our palliative care, and we have to offer specialist palliative care support. Palliative care doctors do not want this. They don't believe that this is the right thing to do. And, you know, I think that there has to be a better way.
Tanny Gray Thompson. There is a wide coalition in favour of legalising assisted dying, including the charity and advocacy group Humanist UK. Nathan Stillwell is with them. What does he say to Tanny Gray's concerns?
So those fears haven't appeared in the 31 jurisdictions that allow assisted dying, which is working very, very well. And we know that in every country that's introduced assisted dying, it's well supported and the people want it and the people want that option at the very end of their lives. But what we can't do in the UK is ignore the fact that 20 people a day are dying in pain. That's with the best possible care. And we can't ignore the rights and the voices of these people who are dying.
One of the many other arguments that's used is actually that you can see when somebody is in intolerable pain. It can be a lot more difficult to tell when somebody is coming under pressure, when there is coercion, because it can happen in subtle ways. It can happen behind closed doors, and it can be very difficult for doctors, and in this case, doctors and potentially a High Court judge, to be aware of that.
Sure. So in this bill, the person is asked, from my account, 8 different times whether they want to go ahead. And sometimes that's written and witness declaration, which is then checked by a doctor. So that's numerous, numerous steps where anything could be spotted. And if coercion is spotted, then that's a criminal offence and a new criminal offence introduced by the bill. The point that's really crystal clear is at the moment there are no safeguards. There are no routes for a doctor to spot coercion. If the patient takes their their own life or refuses treatment, food and water, which is their right to do. So introducing any safeguards are going to be better than the system we have right now, which has no safeguards.
Do you think that the bill as is currently constructed is getting it just about right? Or do you think actually it needs to be far more permissive, as indeed is the case in many other jurisdictions? What's your sort of end goal in all this?
So just about over half of the people from the UK who currently go to Switzerland wouldn't be helped by a law that's limited to people who have 6 months left to live. They don't
just to be clear, sorry to interrupt, people go to Switzerland because that is a place where they can kill themselves in a sort of controlled setting.
Yeah.
But it's expensive and they have to get there.
Yeah, and bear in mind the fact that that's a foreign country, and I think that's absolutely horrible that someone's forced to leave their friends, their loved ones, their home to go to a foreign country just to die dignified and compassionately. That's totally wrong.
How wide do you think provision should be?
Ideally, we wouldn't want this to be limited to people who have 6 months left to live, but we understand that that's what politicians have chosen and that's what they're going to debate. And what's really important is that debate isn't stifled, that politicians are able to come to a consensus on this issue. And I think what's being put forward is the consensus, and it's a good bill.
Again, one of the arguments that's put forward is that, look, no one wants to see anybody in intolerable suffering, but what we should be concentrating on is making end-of-life care all the better. This is a distraction from that.
No, not at all. In fact, assisted dying and this debate has put a spotlight on palliative care and end-of-life care. And the conversations we've already heard since this debate has really kicked off have really highlighted that importance. And there was a 14-month assisted dying inquiry put forward by the House of Commons, by the Health and Social Care Select Committee. And that inquiry found that where countries introduce assisted dying, palliative care can improve. These two things can happen at the same time.
I don't know how far you've been able to follow the debate today. There's been several hours. I just wonder what you make of the quality of the debate.
The only thing we'd like to point out is that a lot of people have deeply held religious motivations for supporting or not supporting assisted dying. And those are legitimate. You know, it's right that politicians talk about their religious motivations. But what we think is worrying is sometimes politicians aren't being totally upfront with those motivations. We've definitely seen some politicians criticise the safeguards when we know, in fact, that as well as maybe they have criticism for their safeguards, they also have deeply held religious convictions.
Nathan Stillwell from Humanists UK. The vote is happening as I am speaking. We'll bring the result to you as soon as we get it here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, the fight to keep the power on in Ukraine. We have a report from one of the country's thermal power plants damaged in a Russian strike.
We can't keep up with the restoration work. We don't have time to restore the main equipment, let alone the roof and walls. Everything gets destroyed again from one strike to the next.
That report from Ukraine coming up in about 30 minutes. Our main headlines this hour, over 100 diplomats and civil servants in Georgia have broken their neutrality to express concern over the government's decision to suspend EU accession talks. We'll be talking more about that in about 20 minutes. And as we heard, after an emotional session in Parliament, British MPs are voting on whether to legalise assisted dying. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. And let's cross to France now, where back in 2019, I think it's reasonable to say, many in the country, so proud of their heritage, gasped in shock as the Gothic Jewel, which is the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris, was consumed in flames. At the time, 5.5 years ago, the President Emmanuel Macron declared that the 860-year-old cathedral would be rebuilt within 5 years and be restored to a glory not seen for centuries. Today, President Macron was able to see the results for himself. He was taken on a tour of the building and met some of the highly skilled craftsmen and women involved in the restoration, including the master carpenter Damien Picardy, who spoke to me from within the great cathedral.
Basically, I'm part of a group of traditional carpenters, and we were called to participate in this project because our skills with the axes. So basically, we transform logs into beams using only axes, different type of axes. And we're still using some traditional methods of carpentry.
So it's not just about the fact that you were trying to restore Notre Dame to its former magnificence, but that you were using traditional techniques to do so. I mean, techniques stretching back hundreds of years. What was the advantage of trying to work in that way?
Well, there's a lot of benefit using this technique. First, structurally, sound is much, much, much resistant. It will be a carpentry that will last for a century, as they proved just before the fire. Also, using the axes, we are able to follow the shape of the tree, the original shape. For us, as an artisan, we get a connection with the material, much, much intimate. So all that energy, all that effort gets transmitted to every single beam that we touch. So the overall result is astonishing. It's beautiful and a lot more strong.
You say the overall result is astonishing. You have now been one of the privileged few who have seen inside the fully restored Notre Dame. What's it been like?
Oh, it just, as you say, is a privilege, is an honor, and I'm very lucky to be involved in this project. The cathedral now, it looks just fantastic, like it did 800 years ago. So for anyone who's going to come to visit it, they'll be completely astonished. It's just, I have no words to describe it. It's like, you have to come and see it.
All I can say is that just watching some of the pictures from the television feed, it does look amazing inside. It's remarkable that the French president, he set this very punishing timetable of getting it all done in 5 years, but he said he wanted Notre Dame to come back even more beautiful. And there is that, I mean, from what I've seen of the two-dimensional pictures, it looks, it's sort of shining in its magnificence.
It is, because I've been inside the cathedral before the fire, and it was all dusty, and was a bit dark throughout the centuries, all the smoke from the candles and the pollution around the city, and now it's been clean, so it's all white and shiny. All the gold leaves are like shining through all the single bulbs there in the cathedral, so it's kind of a spectacular to walk in.
Yeah, and the fact that you and your colleagues, that you have this connection now with it in a very sort of visceral way. You, as you say, you haven't been just involved in sort of reconstructing the body of the cathedral, but you've been doing so in a way that really connects you to the history of the construction of the cathedral.
Yes, so we have that kind of burden and responsibility, you know, to respect their work. And for us, I think we did it and very well. And the community that grew, that was born throughout this process, is just fantastic. I mean, all the people I met on site and on the workshop, they're just, we're all there with the same goal, just to get it done in time and having fun in the process.
That sounded utterly wonderful. Damien Pinardi, I miscalled him Picardi earlier on. I do apologise to him. Damien Pinardi, one of the carpenters who were involved in the restoration of Notre Dame in Paris. Now, just within the last minute or so, we've had the result of the vote in the House of Commons, the lower chamber of the British Parliament, on whether to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales. And our correspondent, Rob Watson, who's at Westminster, can bring us the result. Rob, what is it?
So those in favour, 330. Those against, 275. So that is a majority of 55 in favour, Tim, of what could only be described as a truly seismic moment in social policy here. I was about to say Britain, Tim, but of course it is just England and Wales, but a seismic moment nonetheless, because yes, this is provisional, there are still other stages, but essentially MPs have backed the idea of the state for the first time assisting in the deaths of some of its sisters, citizens, albeit of course in very restricted circumstances.
Yeah, just remind us briefly what the guardrails are as this bill currently in its current iteration. What they are in terms of the process of assisted dying.
So they're very tight, Tim. You have to have a diagnosis of 6 months to live. You need to have your decision approved by two doctors and a High Court judge.
Right. Now, what happens next? Because you did say this is, you know, we're partway through the process. In the jargon, it's the second reading. Where now for this?
So essentially, more scrutiny by a committee of MPs. There will also be scrutiny in the House of Lords, the upper chamber. And then, of course, it will all come back to MPs for another vote. So the poll process probably take several months, certainly go into the new year, Tim. And as to when the MPs who back this really, truly dramatic change in the law, when they expect it to come into force for the first people to be able to have assisted deaths would be about 2 years from now.
There has been a bit of controversy in the way, in the run-up to this vote, because it's a free vote, so it hasn't gone along party lines. People can vote according to their conscience, as it's called, and there had been a bit of a kerfuffle over whether some members of the cabinet, senior members of the government, had been weighing in when they were asked to not to. The Prime Minister, do we know how he voted?
Well, my colleagues say they're pretty sure that Sir Keir Starmer voted in favour. I mean, he said that he had before, so it would be unlikely that he had again this time. And it's important to remember that in one of his former roles, he was head of the prosecution department in Britain, right? So it would have been his job to go after people who had either helped people with terminal illnesses to commit suicide or who'd gone off to Switzerland to do it. So, you know, he's someone with who's had keen experience of it. And as to the controversy you mentioned, it's absolutely right, two very senior ministers whose departments would have a big role in this. The health minister and the justice minister have both said they didn't like the idea, and some had thought, well, maybe that had exerted undue influence, but in the end it doesn't seem to have made much difference to him.
And I realise obviously this has far greater implications than the standing of Westminster, and we've heard some of the arguments earlier in the programme in favour and against the idea of assisted dying, but just in terms of this day for the standing of Westminster, I mean, it's taken an absolute battering in recent years. Lots of people thinking that the standard of politics in this country is appalling. It's been an intense but respectful debate, isn't it?
It has. I've watched pretty much every minute of it since 09:30, and you can't help thinking, Tim, that if the majority of Britain's 45 million eligible voters had been watching it, that maybe it would have somewhat improved their view of their politicians, because, you know, yes, it was passionate, yes, it was emotional, but people listened incredibly respectfully to each other's arguments, and these are, you know, big arguments of principle as well as practicality. And I think, obviously, those who lost the vote, they'll be disappointed, but they could all slap themselves on the back for conduct, at least.
Rob Watson, our political correspondent at Westminster, thank you very much for bringing us the result of that vote. You're listening to NewsHour. We're going to catch up now on one of the sports stories of the year. 20-year-old Emmanuel Wanyonyi became the youngest men's 800 metres champion in Olympic history. It was an achievement all the more remarkable because of his astonishingly tough childhood. BBC Sport Africa's Kelvin Kimathi has been speaking to Emmanuel at his family home in Saboti, Western Kenya.
Feeding cattle isn't easy work, even for an Olympic champion. But for Emmanuel Wanyonyi, it's part of who he is.
Looking after cattle as a child was tough, but I had to do it so I could eat. Sometimes I wasn't paid, but it gave me a place to sleep.
Born in Saboti village, Western Kenya, Wanyonyi was one of 11 children in a family struggling with poverty. At the age of 10, he dropped out of school to help provide for his loved ones.
When I got something small, I would take it home to my siblings so they could also have something to eat. It's the only reason I endured the job.
Wanyonyi sometimes earned less than $2 a month, and sometimes he was paid nothing at all.
There was a man I was working with. He was a police officer. He was very strict. He used to wake me up and tell me he wanted me to cut big trees and dig out the lower roots. I did it for 3 months. I built my house in iron sheets.
Aged 13, Wanyonyi returned home, and that's when he discovered his talent for running.
When I was training at one of the nearby school grounds, the teacher noticed me and told me I can run very well and get into athletics, but I will have to go back to school. When I came back to school, my dad was really happy. He would see me going to practice, and he loved that a lot.
Wanyonyi's father worked as a caretaker at a dam. But tragedy struck when he was found dead at the site in 2018, a day that lives long in Wanyonyi's mind.
My father was working, guarding water for someone to prevent people from destroying the pipes. He had never come to school before. I was in class and he made sure I was called and I went to the fence. He gave me about $2 and told me to go buy running shoes. It's like he was strangled and placed by the water. He was found with a mark on his head, as if he was hit. What I think happened is that he placed his clothes there to swim, and then someone came to rob him. I wish he was here to see me run. I would even push harder because of all the love he had for me.
And despite his father's death, Wanyonyi quickly rose through the athletics ranks on his way to gaining a place in the Kenyan national team. His coach, Claudio Beraldelli, continues to be impressed.
Something which is unique in Wanyonyi is his mental attitude. It's like he's fearless, probably because of his background. But what makes a champion to be a champion is the mental attitude, and he's a champion in his mind.
Coach Claudio Beraldelli ending that report by Kelvin Kamathi. In Kenya. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Tim Franks. And within the last few minutes, British MPs have voted to advance a bill which would legalise giving the terminally ill the right to end their own lives.
The ayes to the right, 330. The noes to the left, 275. The ayes have it, the ayes have it.
That was the Speaker of the House saying that the votes were 330 in favour of the assisted dying legislation being allowed to proceed, 275 against. The BBC's Rob Watson, our political correspondent, has been watching the debate for the last 5 hours or so. Rob, we had you on the programme just a few minutes ago, but for those joining us now, just remind us what this bill is about and where it goes next.
So the big picture is that it is a seismic change in social policy here. There's no doubt about it, because for the first time, albeit in very restricted circumstances, the state is willing to assist, or certainly begun that process of assisting, in the death of some of its citizens. Now, narrowing in, this bill has been drafted in a very narrow way to try and have lots of safeguards. So the conditions are, before you are eligible for this, you have to have a terminal diagnosis of 6 months. Two doctors have to make sure that you're of sound mind, and it needs to be finally signed off on by a high court judge. So a massive, massive change, even if the law itself is quite restricted in drafting.
Rob Watson, for the time being, thanks ever so much for bringing us the latest from Westminster. Well, let's get an expert outside view on all this, in particular what we can learn perhaps from examples elsewhere, because clearly this is not the first jurisdiction where legislation has been allowed, although we're yet to get to the end point of this legislation, but there is legislation for assisted dying to happen. Nancy Preston is a professor of supportive and palliative care at Lancaster University in Northern England. Professor Preston, very good to have you on NewsHour. A lot has been said by the proponents of this bill that it is going to be among the toughest, if not the toughest, in terms of the restrictions in the world. What's your view?
So we've done research at Lancaster University and looked at different international models, and there is just a huge variance. I think bringing in the High Court judge does make it very restrictive, but there's going to be some real issues about how this can work in practice, which is going to need to be worked out at the committee stage. And I think they really need to understand what this research from different jurisdictions says about the impact on patients, their families, but also healthcare workers, because a lot of this relies on these two doctors in the bill. And we know that only a minority of doctors are willing to take part in assisted dying, even if they're in favour. So this is going to be the challenge, and whether this is even part of the NHS.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, what you're suggesting is that, as much as anything, I mean, people have been talking, obviously, about the sort of the great moral implications of all this. But it could also be about capacity, because we know that the health service is under tremendous pressure. We know that the judicial system is under tremendous pressure as well. Big backlogs in both systems, and to add, in a sense, an extra layer of bureaucracy, however needed it is, may just slow everything down.
That's right. And at the moment, we know in the bill, a doctor would need to assess them, or two doctors. A doctor would then need to prescribe, might need to present to the High Court. And actually, they've got to stay with the patient whilst they administer the drugs. And they talk about self-administration. So there's a practical element here. Is that self-ingestion of a liquid like you have in Oregon? Or is it an IV that has been set up, which happens in Switzerland, and the patient opens the port? So at the moment, these issues are not clear in the bill and need clarifying. And if you think about the Swiss system, this largely happens outside of healthcare, with a huge role of right to die associations. In fact, in most Swiss hospitals, they don't allow assisted dying. And of the ones that do, some of them insist it's right to die doctors who come in and actually do the prescription and set up the drip. So it's not as clear cut as it might seem in the bill at the moment. And I think at committee stage, they've really got to think about these practical elements.
Just briefly, one of the arguments that's put forward by the opponents of this is that it leads, we've seen around the world, that it leads to a decline in the standards of palliative care. What's the evidence for that?
I think probably one of the biggest challenges is working out how do you know what are good standards in palliative care. And the methods to do that internationally are pretty weak. So the latest league tables, which some MPs quoted, have certainly got their critics, because it's really quite hard to judge. What we do know in the other countries, palliative care is nowhere near as developed as in the UK, but the UK has always led on palliative care. And hopefully this really has raised the issue that palliative care needs much better funding, needs much better support.
Professor Nancy Preston, very good to have your expertise on the programme. Thank you very much for joining us. In Syria, rebel fighters are continuing their biggest assault in years against government forces in the northwest of the country. A monitoring group says that since Wednesday, more than 240 people have been killed. The Islamist militant group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is leading the offensive, and dozens of towns and villages across Aleppo and Idlib provinces are reported to have fallen back into the control of HTS and its allies. One rebel fighter said he wanted to help his country take his country back from the forces of President Bashar al-Assad.
I have been displaced for 5 years, but thank God I am now fighting to reclaim our land from the grip of the criminal regime. We will continue on this path, and we call upon people sitting at home to get up and help us take back our country.
Mina Al-Lami is a jihadist media specialist at BBC Monitoring. How does she see the significance of this offensive?
It is quite a big deal, because we haven't had this collective, collaborative efforts across a number of rebel groups in northern Syria working together to carry out an offensive against the government and allied forces. So it's presented as a collective offensive by rebel groups, but clearly, even though they don't mention it, but clearly it is led by a very important group. It's an Islamist group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or the acronym HTS. And HTS used to be Al-Qaeda's branch in Syria, but it severed ties with Al-Qaeda. Now, HTS controls the biggest rebel stronghold, or the remaining stronghold in northern Syria, and that is Idlib. So HTS is leading this offensive, even though it hasn't put its name officially on the branding. And the reason for that, of course, it wants to put more of a mainstream, moderate, neutral face to it rather than an Islamist face or rhetoric. And this is possibly in a way to make sure that other rebel groups in the area take part in the offensive, but also so that it's not possibly singled out in counteraction.
And these rebel forces certainly seem to have made some considerable advances. I mean, they're practically knocking on the door of Aleppo, it seems now, the
Correct.
City of Aleppo. Why now, though? Why has this offensive been launched now?
That's a very good question. And actually, the, you know, a lot of people on Telegram, where all these sources, these rebel sources and the, you know, jihadist groups, Islamist groups are very active, they're asking the same question, why now? And the pundits and propagandists of this campaign are not responding to that and saying, if not now, then when? You know, the government has been escalating in recent months. But of course, what is worth bearing in mind is that the operation was launched hours after Israel and Hezbollah agreed a ceasefire. Now, the relevance of Hezbollah is that these rebel groups say that there is a sizable Hezbollah militia present in Western Aleppo, where these groups are pushing now. So they're saying that we are fighting not only government forces, but Iran-backed militias, Hezbollah militias in Aleppo. The other significant aspect of the timing is that some have said that the rebel groups want to make sure that there is no normalization of ties between Turkey and the Syrian government, which would be really detrimental to the rebel groups in northern Syria.
Mina Alami from BBC Monitoring. Now, briefly to Georgia, the former Soviet Republic in the Caucasus, where there's a polite formality and a rather more confrontational reality. The polite formality is that since last year, Georgia's had the official status of being a candidate to join the European Union. The reality was on full painful show last night as riot police in the capital Tbilisi used pepper spray and water cannon to try to disperse protesters, furious that the Prime Minister has decided to suspend moves to join the European bloc, accusing it of blackmail. His Georgian Dream Party has long stood accused of trying to move the country more into the orbit of Moscow. I'm joined now by Rasa Juknavičienė, a member of the European Parliament from Lithuania. She was this month appointed the Parliament's rapporteur for Georgia. Rasa Juknavičienė, thank you very much for your time. What can the EU do about this?
Now, first of all, Georgian people have to decide, and they decided during the last parliamentary election. But unfortunately, those elections were stolen from them, and those irregularities and those elections were not fair and free. And we in the parliament recently, in European Parliament on Thursday, adopted very strong resolution asking the international community and also Georgia to rerun election because they were not fair and free. And we asked member states not to recognize those elections and to stay away from this government, which, of course, will be not recognized because of that.
Can I just ask, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but just you've said a couple of times these elections were not fair and free. I know that that there has been concern expressed, but the official observer missions, as far as I can tell, have not said, not concluded that they were not fair and free. They've just said they've got concerns about them.
Look, yes, of course, ODIHR will issue their official statement later in month. But the streets cannot wait. And what's happening now in Georgia is not about ODIHR statements. It's about, and those elections were, you know, about like President Salome Zurabishvili rightly mentioned in the very beginning, just after the election, that was special operation from Kremlin. We see hybrid warfare attacks everywhere in so-called post-Soviet area, and not only. We saw this in Moldova, now we see in Georgia. And it's not always those regularities or those rules, old-fashioned, I would say, rules. Some observers are following election in many countries. They are not fit into the situation we have today. It's really more than those irregularities on the day of election.
The Georgian government, just very briefly, because we're almost out of time, the Georgian government says that it does want to deepen relations with the European Union. You seem to be backing off altogether.
They are manipulating, and they were manipulating a lot all the time. No one believed that Bidzina Ivanishvili, who is de facto leader of this country, Georgia Dream, that Russian oligarch, that he is in one moment believed that Georgia will become member of EU. It's, of course, Kremlin plan to take Georgia and Moldova backwards. So this
Rasa, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us. Rasa Juknavičienė, the European Parliament rapporteur for Georgia. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. And let's head back to our big story this hour. It is that British MPs have voted to advance a bill which would legalise giving the terminally ill in England and Wales the right to end their own lives. In the last 30 minutes, MPs voted 330 to 275 to allow the bill to move to the next stage. One of those stages would involve it going up to the upper chamber, the House of Lords. Charlie Faulkner is a member of the House of Lords and joins me now. Lord Faulkner, you're a proponent of this bill. I know there you've had many arguments that you'd like to advance, but what are the main ones in its favour?
Well, I think the main ones in its favour are that if you are terminally ill and you are dying and in the process of a terminal illness, you should have the option to be helped by doctors to bring your life to an end rather than continuing to suffer. But it's obviously subject to safeguards. And over quite a long period of time, that's been a really contentious issue in the United Kingdom. And it was a very, very stunning event in the House of Commons this morning. It lasted for 5 hours. You can see from the vote that over 600 MPs out of about 625 who can vote voted. And there was a clear majority after years and years and years of this being opposed in the UK in favour of this groundbreaking proposition. Now, it's not the end of the road because there needs to be detailed scrutiny. And one of the big issues for many people in the debate was that the safeguards have got to be good enough. But what the Commons voted in this very historic vote was in favour in principle of allowing people to be assisted to take their own life in their last illness, subject to the safeguards being okay.
Can I just ask, I mean, do you think that actually, one of the arguments is that it's too restrictive? Is this, if the legislation were to end up where it currently is that something that you would be happy with?
Yes, I would be happy with it. I think you're absolutely right. There is a group of people who say having to get two doctors to agree and having to get a High Court judge to agree means that too many people will either lose heart and not try to get permission or won't get permission pursuant to the safeguards when they should. But I think one's got to err very much on the side of the bill being very safeguarded.
And against that, of course, is the argument, we heard it from Tanny Gray-Thompson, one of your fellow members of the House of Lords earlier in the programme, which is that one of the things it's terribly difficult to deal with is coercion, because it can happen in subtle ways. It can happen behind closed doors. It can happen when people, even just by themselves, just think, am I being a bit too much of a burden to those around me? And that is something that it's very difficult to draft in legislation, safeguards against that.
Well, what you have to presuppose in order to assume that there was coercion leading to the wrong decision is that somebody could be coerced, whether subtly or unsubtly, and that not to become evident to two doctors and to a High Court judge. A High Court judge, for example, is very used to dealing with questions of whether or not there has been coercion. And if there is doubt, then permission will not be given. It is also instructive to look at other countries where such laws have been introduced. The longest one is Oregon. That's been there for 27 years. And there is literally no evidence of coercion in that jurisdiction.
Charlie Faulkner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
A prominent Chinese journalist has been sentenced to 7 years in jail on charges of espionage. Dong Yu was arrested in Beijing more than 2 years ago while having lunch with a Japanese diplomat. He had been a columnist and deputy editor of the Guangming Daily, a newspaper affiliated with the ruling Communist Party. Joining me now from Washington is Edward Wong, diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. And Edward, thanks for joining us. And am I right in saying that you know Dong Yu?
Yes, I've known Mr. Dong since 2006, and I kept in regular contact with him and his family members while I worked in Beijing for nearly 9 years for the New York Times.
What sort of man is he?
He is a very knowledgeable fellow. He is well-read, well-traveled. He did a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, which is a very prestigious fellowship for international journalist as well as U.S. journalist, and he has done fellowships in Japan. So he is a very cosmopolitan man who was advocating in articles for the continued liberalization of China's economy and greater free speech in China.
It's an odd question to ask somebody, but I mean, what makes you so certain that he is not a spy?
Well, I mean, I know him on a personal level. He's written stories for the New York Times, Chinese website. We are very careful not to employ, obviously, agents of espionage services on our as writers. And just the meetings that are cited in the judgment, according to family members, are absurd. Like the judgment that was read out in court says that he met with the Japanese ambassador at the time. He met with the chief diplomat to Shanghai from Japan. And it says that these diplomats were actors for an espionage service. Of course, we all know that these are very public diplomats, very high-ranking diplomats, and to label them spies is completely absurd.
Did Dong Yu, you said that he advocated within a Communist Party affiliated newspaper for there to be a certain amount of liberalization. Did he ever suggest to you that he thought that, you know, he might be sailing close to the wind?
Well, I think any independent minded Chinese journalist knows that that's a risk, and they often express that to, you know, their friends. And so you did what might have occasionally told me that, but it's par for course for many of these independent-minded Chinese journalists. And that's become increasingly true in the era of Xi Jinping, the current leader of China, where he's clamped down on freedom of press, freedom of speech, what little there was in China. And he said that media must essentially serve the party rather than showing any independence.
Another tough question, but have you any idea how he might deal with 7 years in prison?
I mean, he's 62. He's elderly. He has had some health conditions. So I think his family members are hoping that China will release him early on humanitarian grounds. They're appealing the decision. I think it'll be very difficult for him and for the family members, given his age and his health. And also, I think psychologically, for other Chinese journalists, as well as foreign journalists and diplomats, and business people, this sends a very concerning message because it's essentially China telling the outside world that any people-to-people exchanges could be deemed acts of espionage. And so it increases the risk for anyone traveling back and forth to China or maintaining contact with Chinese citizens.
Edward Wong, diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times, thank you very much for joining us. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.